Hey, welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast. This episode we have Dario Franchitti, three-time Indy 500 winner, four-time IndyCar Series champion, bon vivant, everyone's favorite Scott, or second, depending on whether you know Alan McNish, or his brother Marino, which would bump him down to third pretty quickly. Nonetheless, myself and my colleague Robin Miller sat down with good old Dario Franchitti at Phoenix. Fun conversation, starting off looking at his youth, looking at the first point where he recognized that he was good and this could be a profession. Worked through coming up and had some great fun Dario stories about driving for Mercedes in the DTM, his classic story about getting lost in the woods. Spoke a bit about his brother Marino, what it's like having a talented younger brother, a professional following in his footsteps. Also spoke about his love and passion for collecting motor racing memorabilia, an affliction we all share. Myself, Robin, and Dario spend far too much of the money we make on that. He has better toys, though, because he makes more than us. Anyways, Dario Franchitti, always a pleasure to sit down with him. A lot of comfort, a lot of ease, just like talking with an old friend, because he's an old friend.
So one of the themes I've been trying to explore, at least with some of my early podcasts, when drivers knew they were good, that first thing in life where, hey, this is fun, gee, we're at the kart track or we're wherever, what that point was, where whether it was yourself where you realized, hey, this could be more than just fun, or someone else said, hey, kid, you've got what it takes. Curious when and where that happened.
I think my answer to that depends where I came from. I rode motocross bikes for a little while, and I was terrible on them. So when I actually drove a go-kart for the first time, it all just came together. Even the first test day, it was like, oh, wow.
Wow.
You know, they'd sort of set it up, and I was 10 years old and tiny. I mean, Tony Kanaan, tiny.
Wow.
And they'd set it up so I could sort of trundle around, and I blew the engine up pretty quick because I was wide open on the straight. So I thought straight away that I was clearly a lot better at driving a kart than I was at riding a motorbike. With hindsight, I probably should have stayed off bikes for the rest of my life, but that's another story.
You've had your own Evel Knievel-esque escapades on bikes.
Yeah, exactly. But no, when did I think it would become something more? I always hoped it would.
Yeah.
But it was that kind of childhood dream more than a career path plotted or anything silly.
Wow.
I suppose when I won my first car championship, I thought, okay. And then when I signed for Jackie and Paul Stewart Racing, it started to become a bit more serious. And then I got my ass kicked in that first season with them. So, you know, it was a bit of fluctuating. The roller coaster of racing life was definitely in full effect.
So from a momentum standpoint, obviously, Jackie played a key role in starting the Franchitti experience the world has come to know. I know we hear about that a lot, but I'm sure there had to be some others, maybe not as well known, maybe privately somewhere else, that also helped, I guess, add some fuel to your early career.
Yeah, the Jackie experience is funny because he came to race a couple of years ago. It would have been 2014. And Chip asked him to come in and give the boys a pep talk, and he came in and gave them this sort of pep talk and talked to the engineers and the drivers about what was important. And the drivers and the engineers halfway through started looking at me, and he left the room afterwards, and they said, okay, how much did you pay him? And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, it was what he taught me. I sort of try and sort of pass that down. So it was quite funny all those years later. It was sort of the same things I sort of try and help the guys out with, is what Jackie taught me. But as far as other people, I mean, there were so many. Obviously my parents, and you know, David Leslie, father,
yeah,
and son.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, but there was all kinds of just family, friends who, you know, one bought the car that I raced the first year. And then sold it the year, you know, sold it after. Guys who give a little bit of sponsorship, you know, whether it was Alan McNish helping me get a helmet from Bell,
His certainly wouldn't fit, so he'd have to have some help.
He didn't fit, but it was that kind of stuff. And it was all those people that along the way that were, you know, whether it was the guys from Autosport.
Mm.
But later on, when Mercedes said, okay, who do we want to look at some young drivers to replace Klaus Ludwig? He's leaving to Opel. We want to run the junior program. Who should we pick?
And they were so influential for so many careers. I mean, I know today's Autosport might not be as powerful as it once was, but just in terms of legacy, there are a lot of drivers who owe their careers to, whether it's a recommendation or their the award and whatnot. I mean, pretty amazing.
Certainly that second step, you know, when I went to Mercedes, to them, because as Norbert called up, it was either Norbert or Wolfgang Schattlin called up the guys at Autosport, and Peter Fubister, Andy Holbury, Lawrence Foster all went, him and Oliver Gavin, and that was, and Ollie and I went and tested the car, and that was it.
So you opened the door to one of my favorite conversation themes we've had over the years, and that's DTM/ITC/ those cars. There's a book. There has to be a book to be written about just the technical side of the cars alone. Obviously, the racing side as well, but you've always shared a great passion for the madness that era, that mid-90s DTM, where Formula One couldn't even boast some of the allowances that those cars had. What is it that you loved about that openness and some of the fun technology you had to play with?
I wish people could see me sitting here smiling at that question. Especially in a world nowadays dominated by very tight regulations and
spec.
A lot of spec, and you know, whether it's, you know, IndyCar, F1, NASCAR, everything's going more and more towards this tight regulation. And DTM, I was talking to somebody about it yesterday. I can't actually imagine what the rule book said, because we had
be nice to each other. The end.
Yeah, exactly. Make sure it's got four. If I didn't even have to have four doors, the Opals were two door. But it was this case of four. We had four wheel drive cars, two wheel drive cars. Everything was V6, 2.5 liter V6.
Sounded amazing.
Stunning. If you guys listening haven't done it, go on YouTube and just type in, you know, DTM. To hear these things just screaming. They had movable aerodynamics.
And ballast, movable ballast.
Movable ballast, that was always fun when we first started testing that. I thought,
what did that feel like? I always wondered.
I thought it was April 1st when they said, oh yeah, we try a movable ballast today. Okay, how's that going to work? And it was basically a piece of tungsten.
Tungsten, yeah.
And a big piece of tungsten. I'm talking three mechanics to lift it.
Oh,
piece.
God.
It wasn't a subtle change. With a hydraulic ram. And basically...
The tunnel of the car, kind of in the middle?
Where the gearbox... I think it ran, might have run below the diff. I think it ran below the diff and out the back. It certainly came out the back the first time I tried it.
Three mechanics.
I headed out the back of the pits at Estoril and accelerated hard, and the however heavy this thing was dangling out the back of the car, smashing the carbon fiber to pieces. So that was a kind of a dud. So we tried again a couple of weeks later. And I braked hard for a hairpin, and it came through the front of the car. But eventually we got it, so it was good. But the whole premise of those cars, they worked on distance. And everything was programmed into them on distance. So you could move, the roll bars worked on a system where you could soften it or stiffen it. You didn't have to do it. You just said, I want the front to turn better there, so they would
so you
soften
pass start door. Finish the car would trigger the data system would trigger, the car would know where it was and knew that 412 meters ahead, make this thing happen.
Exactly, make this happen aerodynamically, make this happen mechanically, do this with the movable ballast. We had a wing that we tested at Hockenheim on the Grand Prix track there that would, well, as soon as the car got straight at a pre-programmed point, it would disappear in the boot lid, or trunk lid, as you guys would call it. And this thing would haul ass down the straight, and just before you braked, hopefully, it would pop back up on its hydraulic rams. Sometimes it didn't.
What level of trust you have to have? Because it's one thing to be a racing driver looking for limits and such. It sounds like you also have a feel like, damn, this thing's alive. Can I trust what the you know? Is this thing going to kill me?
You had to have a lot of faith in what these guys were doing. And it did tend to go on fire a lot, too. Because all the hydraulic hoses, I mean, it's, but they were wonderful. The sad thing about that wing, we developed it at Mercedes, and the DTM banned it. And the next race, the race it was built for, I think it was Klaus Ludwig went past me, and he had one on the Opel, was banned from Mercedes, but not for Opel. So
wow.
I was a little grumpy about that. But then the car went on fire and I forgot about it.
So I'll ask you a little later about memorabilia, because you and I are both people that spend more money than we should on things that we love from the past. Well, we got Robin Miller here, who owns half of Indianapolis. I seem to recall you have a piece of memorabilia from your DTM days, a door.
Actually, I moved it the other day.
Okay.
It's not a door, it's part of a door.
Part of a door. So can you tell the story of how you have a piece of a Mercedes door as memorabilia? And folks might have heard this story, but it never gets old.
It was a carbon door, as all things were in the DTM car, and it weighs about the same as a pair of sunglasses, the bit that I have. And it was signed by the test team because I had a habit of destroying the test cars. I never really crashed a race car much, but the test car, every time I drove it, I wiped it out.
You found the limits.
Yeah. So I signed for Mercedes, and we had the 94 car, which was the first of the Class 1 cars. The 95 car was a massive step up, and Schneider had been testing it, as he should, because he was the most experienced driver, the team leader. And eventually, for some reason, Gerhard Unger and the guys decided, okay, it's time to let the kids into it. So I was the first of the kids to get to go play. And we were testing at Hockenheim. We used to test 9 to 12 at Hockenheim every day for noise abatement. That was it. So you'd have to test for a week there to get anything meaningful done.
Wow.
And you would run on the track with streetcars and trucks and buses and smart cars at the same time as you're hauling around there in a DTM car. Oh, yeah. So I'm going out, and it was like, I think it was Thursday, and I'd been testing all week with this car, and I kept complaining of it having a fast corner oversteer, aerodynamic oversteer, and we couldn't fix it. And they were like, yeah, we'll fix it later, we know the problem. I was like, well, can we do something now? No. So me now at 42 years old would say, okay, I should just maybe take it a little easy through the fast corners, but no, me 21 years old, I'm going to show these guys,
of course,
which is actually obviously half a lifetime ago, I'm going to show them how fast I am. Well, one morning, went out the pits at 9 o'clock, to point, some of the engineers weren't even at the track yet. Gerhard Unger, the chief engineer at the time, great pal of mine, hadn't even arrived. So I head out of the pits, new tire, qualifying run, qualifying sim, which, knowing that the car had this imbalance, was a little brave of them. Anyway, so I go out the back, it was one lap qualifying, and I come, there's a left-right flat chicane. I turn left, the car snaps.
How fast are you going at that point?
160 maybe. The car spins, hits the barrier backwards, flips over backwards. I don't know what happened then, because I closed my eyes. I thought at one point, I thought, okay, it stopped because it's gone quiet. In the air, and it landed nose down, and it just kept lunching itself. It just absolutely destroyed itself. It bent the steering wheel, snapped the pedals, it broke the seat, it took the trumpets out of the V of the V6
oh my
engine.
God.
There was nothing left. This was a prototype. This was a hand built.
Oh yeah,
prototype. They hadn't made copies of the parts yet to start making the production, because we had 6 or 8 cars to build. So I get out of the car, a bit dazed, and the guy stops in one of the old cars, Mercedes street cars that he's doing a mileage test with. And he says, you want to lift back to the pits? And I sort of jump in the thing. We head back. And Gerhard's now there. I'm standing shaking, just with the adrenaline, the whole thing. And I can't even speak to him. I can't even use the words I used, but I basically told him that the car was junk. And he was like, what? And so the car's... Anyway. The mechanics have seen all they saw was the voltage going to zero
on the
engineers, on the telemetry. So they've gone, it must have stopped. So they've gone out in the bus to come round the track.
Disappearing Dario.
And they've stopped at this crash site. It looks like an aircraft crash. And apparently they spent the next half an hour running around the forest looking for me, thinking I've run off in shock. but I nearly got fired for that one. Yeah, it was nearly the end of the whole thing.
Wow.
But I managed to stick it on pole for the first race and all was forgiven, thank God, because that was nearly the end of a beautiful relationship.
We'd be talking to Dario the shop owner,
Dario,
the banker.
Master criminal, possibly. I'm not sure what I would have done.
I love it. I don't want to segue necessarily into master criminals, but it brought to mind... I was going to say your brother, not the master criminal, but some of one of your brother's former employers. What's it like coming up, someone who's shown skill, whose career is taking off, and having a younger brother who has talent, has skill, has the ability to have a career. What's that like for you from a help versus let him develop on his own? You two are incredibly close, but just curious how hands-on you have been in trying to help Marino in his early days, how much you let him learn on his own.
It was always an interesting one with, you know, take Marino and Paul DiResta, because, you know, Paul I was sort of very involved with. I was, you know, in times of time and also financially, you know, helping him up through the ladder. His dad had helped me at times.
Sure.
Marino always got the handoffs. When I was racing karts, Marino was like 8 years old, and he was racing guys like Dan Weldon, Jensen Button, all these guys, and they had all the great gear. And Marino had all the stuff that was kind of, you know, and it taught him a certain toughness, I think. And we didn't really take it seriously, we being sort of my dad and I. And you know, it was only a bit later Marino really started to take it seriously. And he did it all on his own, actually. You know, as far as advice, I gave him a bit of advice, but he did it all on his own. He took his own path. He always wanted to go to sports cars. Never wanted to race an Indy car, an F1 car. He always wanted to race sports cars. Derek Bell was his hero, and he always wanted to do that. And so, he through determination and grit and a lot of skill, you know, seeing what he's achieved is just it's amazing. And you watch, you know, when he won Sebring in 14, I was a mess. I was sitting in a hotel in Texas, an absolute mess. to just see how, you know, how he fulfilled that potential that he had. And mentally, I don't think there's anybody tougher than my little brother.
Oh yeah, yeah.
You know, the knocks that he's had and stuff, and the fact he's now in the Ford GT program is just,
I mean,
perfect.
You've seen your brother destined for Le Mans as part of Ford's return. You know, that he has a point of pride. Not just for you, but everybody who knows and loves Marino. That's one of those, okay, good things do happen to good people.
Absolutely. I'm tearing up here a little bit. It's just the coolest thing. And he's so proud of it, to represent Ford and with their anniversary coming up. And he gets that part of it, but he also gets in the car and, you know, just drives the crap out of it. I was lucky enough to race with him a couple of times in the long distance stuff. The last time was at Petit a few years ago, and we had so much fun. Although the little shit was quicker than me, which really annoyed me, and almost stacked the car trying to be as quick as him. So it's nice to see him get his hard work and what his talent deserves.
Do you have an appreciation for what it's been like for Marino being the brother of? And when you said Petit, that reminded me of an experience we recounted, I think, from 2008. When you were inquiring about, hey, I would like to park the bus. You guys are charging outrageous sums here for the event. Can I do some sort of media trade-off? I always, the outcome of that a certain PR person is a COCK, one of my all-time favorite lines of yours.
That's right, I forgot about it.
I don't know, I can retell that if you want, but I thought of that scenario where they asked you, you said, hey, can we do some sort of trade? You forget the bill for the parking, and I'll help you with some media stuff. And they wanted you to do, you know, 27 hours of stuff, all kinds of crazy beyond the norm. And when you declined that, what did they do? And they turned and said something like, well, what about, you know, can we have the other Franchitti, as if it was just like this second trade-off thing? It didn't sit well with anybody.
I don't remember the exact words of it, Marshall, but yeah, there was stuff like that. And it's been tough for him. It's been bloody tough, and he doesn't, I don't think, and hasn't got the respect he deserves because of that. And he's forged his own path, and it's not some thing that I'm sort of phoning people on his behalf. I haven't done anything with, whether it's the Ford thing or anything. He got me my last sports car drive, you know, when we drove together. He organized all that, but all he's wanted was to be his own guy and be judged on his own merits, which I think finally is happening.
I have a theme I want to build, and I know it's going to take a while, and maybe I'll break some of these out for special edition podcasts, telling kart stories. Because I think especially the era of kart that you came into, crazy power, tire wars, special times, not something we haven't discussed many times in the past, but do you have any certain cars, tracks that stand out from your time in kart when you had crazy everything at your disposal that as a driver you just think back on and go, I can't believe I got to do that. That was like trying to ride a bolt of lightning.
I'm sitting here again smiling, thinking back. The first time I drove one of those cars was a Homestead. It was a 96 car that Carl had I think borrowed from
Carl Hogan
had borrowed from the Bettenhausen guys to let me get some track time. I couldn't believe something accelerated like that. I couldn't believe, actually. The biggest problem I had was that the steering was so heavy, as it continues to be today, but it was so heavy. And my DTM car power steering, every time I took my hand off the wheel to pull the sequential shifter back on an upshift, the car would wander across the track. I couldn't control the car with one hand. And that was in a straight line. I had to go to the gym when I got home. Where to start? The 98 Honda that I drove, the Reynard Honda Firestone, the first of the cool cars I drove, the smoothness of that. That was a turbocharged car that drove like an 8-litre V8.
Really?
Just endless torque, beautiful power, drivability like crazy. Greg used to like just give me such a hard time. I'm trying to be polite about that, but you can imagine the words I'm thinking, because we'd test at Sebring and he'd change gear 40-something times a lap and I'd be like 26. Because you just didn't have to with that engine.
Tractability is amazing. Wow.
Beautiful. And the tyres, those soft tyres. I remember testing at Sebring. It would have been 98. Not Sebring, I'm sorry. Portland in 98. Doing a tyre test. And anybody that knows the track at Portland, you go through the first chicane and there was a right triple apex.
Awesome.
The first right was wide open. The second one was a slight lift. And then the third one was banging it down a gear, a little dab on the brakes and back to the power. I've never experienced grip like it. I couldn't carry my bags in the airport that night because I'd ripped every muscle in my forearms just hanging on. And I remember coming into the pits and saying to Don Halliday, Don, the car can go faster. I just physically can't. I can't hang on to it, man. They had power. They had grip. Technology. I don't know. They caught everybody's imagination. I'm not sure you get away with it today, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But
that, then, imagination's the word. That's there are many practical reasons for where we are today in motor racing in IndyCar with spec this, cost control that. There are some valid reasons for it, but if you're fortunate to have lived like Robin and seen many generations of IndyCars, yourself, myself, we might say imagination is the one thing that we're lacking a bit today.
Yeah, it's tough.
You know, and strictly from a vehicle standpoint.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, going to that cost thing for a second. The last road course race we did in the kart era was 2002 Mexico, and I always am reminded that Honda had to come up with a special fuel system because of the altitude or something, and they had getting vaporization in the fuel or something, and they spent seven figures to figure this out for one race, and they were leaving the series the next race. That was, I mean, they had qualifying engines. All the manufacturers did qualifying engines. You know, they were just throwing engines at it, throwing the speed of development, and it was wonderful. But you know, I don't think anybody's spending money in racing in that way nowadays. With maybe the exception of a couple of F1 teams and a couple of WEC teams with Porsche and
sure,
you know, those guys, maybe Audi. I'm not even sure Toyota is.
No, not Toyota. I guess as I look towards that kart era, I know that Robin has spoken to you many times about your dear teammate, Mr. Tracy. Whenever we discuss him, there's always the what can we say on the record and what language can we use, knowing that this is among friends. Can you share just some experiences of what it was like racing against the craziest Canadian we all know? Tag might lead that, but in a different way. But
yeah,
what was life like with PT?
I don't think you have to qualify that with Canadian.
Good point.
Starting, first of all, he was the first guy, the first of the big sort of guns when I was coming in 97 to put his arm around me and say, look, man, if whatever you need, just come and ask me. Which meant a lot. You know, it's Paul Tracy. he's a rock star. When he became my teammate, I mean, we and I've said this before to people, that there was never any mind games. There was never any of that crap.
Well, he'd have to have a mind for you to have mind games with him, but
I'll tell you, he's a lot smarter than people give him credit for, but we crashed together a lot.
That's what I love about that time, is two of the fastest young guns in the series, Paul with a few years under him, plus that Penske pedigree. So, I mean, this, it might have been friendly in at, it might have been friendly, but there was nothing given between the two of you on track.
No, absolutely not. And he had a tough time because I came in there as definitely the sort of the underdog. I was the young kid who'd finished last in the championship, and, you know, I think my best result was ninth or something. And I came in and started running at the front straight away, and I was definitely a bit quicker, and I started winning races and I finished third in the championship that for 98, and Paul wasn't quite there, and I think that was hard for him, but he was never anything less than straight up. And as I say, we got on great. We made Barry tear his hair out a few times and cost him a few dollars, but I mean, where do you start with PT stories? I remember the first time we went testing at Homestead with the new 98 car. Oh, here we go, right, PT's going to run it for the first 2 days, then you're in. Okay, on the oval. So end of the first day, he got a flat, got a cut tire just as he turned into turn three, and the car swapped ends. Wow. And he hit the wall. I mean, he hit a ton, and there were springs rolling down the track and gear ratios, you know, just that kind of size of shunt, massive. We all just stood and went, and I'd never really heard a car hit.
Incredible.
With and the noise just it
scary
up.
Too.
He stands up out of this thing, brushes himself off, and starts walking back down the track. And we were all going, oh my God, I mean, this is unbelievable. Then you realise, later, looking at the car, that he had taken the Penske carbon seat that fitted the PC, whatever, and this is pretty bad, but they basically used some metal and riveted the seat into place in the tub.
Oh, good Lord.
So when he's hit, the seat's broken free. It's the dash bulkhead's cut his legs, and he's gone through the fuel cell bulkhead.
Oh, Jesus.
And he just got out and brushed himself off. He was like, wow. Next day he was a little sore, but even the PT's indestructible.
God, yeah. Thank goodness we still have him.
Yeah.
Well, we need to wrap up here momentarily. You've got a meeting to go to. Let's end on something fun, maybe touching back on memorabilia. The smiles on your face when you have whatever it is in the bag, hey, come take a look at this. I love the fact that not only, you know, have you had an amazing career, but you want to celebrate the things, the drivers you love, the stuff you've loved, and now you're pulling up something on your phone to show us. But tell, I don't know, let's end on just talking about your passion for curating memorabilia.
My Cortina in 64 with Jimmy driving at Crystal Palace. Obviously Jimmy's Cortina that I've just happened to have now, but
who is this Jimmy guy he's always talking about? Yeah. Never heard of
Jimmy
him.
Jones, he's got a Subway place.
Yeah. Well, it's funny, we're actually sitting here with my main supplier of memorabilia.
The mother of God, I hope I'm in his will.
He has spent so much money and called in so many favors to get me different bits of memorabilia. Really cool stuff. Like round about the speedway, especially in Jimmy Clark, and so Robin's got me a lot of cool stuff, and yes, you are in my will.
Attaboy, thanks.
I don't know why it's so important to me. I have rooms of just, some people call it crap, I call it treasure. Whether it's stuff that most of the suits I wore from, I mean, it starts with my dad's like last race suit and goes right through my karting suits, wow, blah, 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 to the last suit I wore in Houston. Helmets, stuff. I've got drawers full. Each year's got a drawer, and it's stuff like maybe fans gave me, or it was a contract that's in there, or pictures, passes, you know, you name it, just all kinds of crap like that. And it's all there laid out, so you can sort of sit and, you know, reminisce sometimes and have a look. And then the stuff from other people. There's helmets from drivers that I admire. We did helmet swaps, or I went out and bought helmets from guys that I liked, or race suits. And there's a whole separate room for the Jimmy Clark stuff.
You showed me one time, which, again, it was the gravity of it. You were looking at me and laughing a little bit because it took me a while to get it. But you showed me, I believe it was Jimmy's flight log.
Yeah.
Which had, and it, again, I was thumbing through it, and you were kind of patiently waiting, all right, moron, get to the last page. But, you know, included the entry for his final flight. And just stuff like that where, for those who know or are familiar of, you know, Jimmy's life and whatnot, I saw that. Sort of, oh, my God. But I appreciate the fact that these are things you want to have, you want to preserve. And
Well, we have the Jim Clark Room in Scotland, and Duns is sort of the main village where close to where I grew up. And I'm a trustee of that. And we've just been given a couple of decent grants from the government to expand that. We're going to put cars in it now. And hopefully, the plan is that a load of us that have Jimmy Clark memorabilia will be able to sort of put that on display and you know, let the room have the use of it and that kind of stuff, whether it's cars or, you know, or the flight logs or, you know, I have all kinds of unbelievably random stuff connected to Jim's life. It'd be cool to put that on display and let people see it and when they go down there, because the room's got some cool stuff too, trophies and Indy 500 winners rings, the Borg plaque, you name it.
Brilliant. Well, Mr. Frank Kitty, we will do some more catching up next time we get a chance.
Anytime.
Thanks, mate.
Thank you.
As I always say, now should I have been recording this?
Right, I got an engineering meeting.
And he's still in that engineering meeting. Haven't seen the lad since. Been a few months. Should probably check in on him. We are planning to do a follow-up podcast this month of May, talk about his IndyCar career in the Indy 500 specifically, so that should be coming up soon. Thanks for listening in. Check out more podcasts and other content at MarshallPruitt.com.